Everybody, this is Armand Dumel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with a positive mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, things to think about. We've been noticing something. Think about phrases related to space. Today we're going to talk about space, the whole concept of space, not outer space. My space.
Your space.
Space for rent.
Space travel.
Inner space.
How about personal space?
How about spaced out?
Space savers.
That's right. I need some space.
I do too. Our space.
Yeah, how about crawl space?
Mm.
You know, these are all... Space is a commodity, or we believe that space is a commodity. Think of things in life that are based on the concept of space, like cubicles,
mm-hmm.
right? Neighborhoods,
yeah,
based on space.
You know, Armand, it's so interesting to watch how humans behave in relation to their space. Let's look, for instance, at a study that was done as a result of an observation. A psychologist was one day walking by a daycare, nursery school, and he noticed that the children were playing inside a space that was limited by a fence. And this psychologist thought, gee, how sad that, you know, children should have to be confined in that way. And he noticed that the children were all hanging onto the fence as if they had wanted to bypass the fence. So I don't know how he managed to ask the school to remove the fences so that the children would have the freedom to go wherever they wanted within a wider space without fences, and so the fences were removed. Guess what, Armand? When the fences were removed, what was seen was that all the children would huddle together in the center of that space.
This we're going to explore with you today, this whole concept of space. Think about where would architecture be without the study of space? Where would interior design be? Apartments, a concept? Your space, your home, being fenced in. How about claustrophobia? Claustrophobia is a whole based on space, right?
Claustrophobia.
Fear of being closed in.
Claustrophobia is having a very difficult relationship with space.
And what do you call people who are afraid to go out?
Agoraphobia.
Yes, and then there's acrophobia.
Acrophobia. Acrophobia, fear of heights.
That's fear of heights. Mm. And then there's agoraphobia.
No, there's agoraphobia.
What? Agro, using it.
Agro, fear of agriculture?
Agra is the town where the Taj Mahal is. So that's the fear of the Taj Mahal.
Is that what it is?
No, I'm sorry. It's just acrophobia. Acrophobia is fear of heights. This is all called the study of proxemics, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Proxemics.
Edward T. Hall in 1968 was a behaviorist who observed that people have a way to protect, maintain, establish, and relate to their space, other people's space, and there is a code of behavior that goes along with space that has a set of rules of its own that are absolutely fascinating.
Fascinating, my friends, because, you know, a lot of you may wonder, how is it happening? You know, for example, our belief is that the more crowded we get, the more violent we get. So let's take a look at some of these studies. There are ways that we define our space. There are cultural rules, biological boundaries, explicit as well as implicit. For example, that we'll talk about later, facial expressions, gestures, postures, all define space in a way. But more importantly, let's look at this thing about distance. I like mm-hmm. that first, right?
Well, you know, Armand, you mentioned the studies where space, where it was shown that the more crowded we are, the more violent we become. That's actually true for rats.
Rats is right.
Not for primates and not for humans. In fact, the opposite is true, that the more crowded primates are, including humans, the more aggression goes down.
So if you were to take this whole belief that if you were to take a space and crowd it more and more and more, a few people may become claustrophobic. But what happens is people calm down in crowded spaces. Just look at what happens on a subway. You have a crowded subway.
Mm-hmm.
People are not violent.
No, because they know that the closeness to another person is unnatural, is not normal to stand that close to someone else. So we all know that that doesn't feel safe, right? It's not normal to have someone 2 inches away from you, unless it's someone you know really, 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 really well. So when you have to stand next to a stranger because there's no choice, intuitively, instinctively, the brain and nervous system decide to put out signals of non-aggressive behavior, of non-engaging even. You don't engage eye to eye. You don't, you know, you don't look around and stare at people when you're in that condition where you're in a crowded subway, because that would be considered a sign of too aggressive for such a small space.
So hundreds of people, thousands of people could travel in the same subway system, crowded against each other, holding against each other, and something happens. They seem to go numb because their bodies are not active, because just the very stimulation of being pressed against another body would mean, you know, everybody would be getting sexually stimulated. No, that doesn't happen. They don't get aggressive. They don't fight each other. The thing that happens is you go calm and you cooperate. The more crowded a space, the more cooperation there is. And perhaps that's because some part of us knows that if we're in a crowded space, we're safe.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you get a bunch
of... Like those toddlers, by the way.
Which toddlers?
The toddlers that I mentioned.
Oh,
in
without
the
fence. Take
right.
away the fence.
Right.
Hall, the scientist who did this, identified 4 bodily distances. He said there are 4 distances that we have. One is called intimate. Another is personal casual. Another is social consultative. And the other is public. Now, he calls the public one 10 feet and beyond. When people are 10 feet and beyond you, that's a public space.
And that means that you feel okay with
feel
them.
Okay because you could see them, you could see what they're doing, you could see a behavior. 4 to 10 feet is called social consultative.
Meaning that they are already in proximity to your space, and therefore you kind of keep an eye on them.
It may not be a direct eye.
No, but you're aware that they're in your space.
Isn't it interesting about women in restaurants?
Very interesting.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You sit in a restaurant. If you sit in a restaurant eating by yourself, right?
Right.
Now we have this difference between women and men.
Yeah, that's actually true in a library. It's true in any kind of public situation whereby you're going to be sitting somewhere with strangers. For men, prefer to have someone sitting next to them and not across from them.
Not directly across, because
no.
Men don't like to be looked at.
Right.
Because I guess it triggers this challenge response. Don't look in my eyes.
But also
if you're another man, don't look in my eyes.
Right. But also, yes, don't look in my eyes, because that's a body language message for challenging to a fight, staring in a a man's eyes, man to man.
That happens with animals, too.
With animals, yes, with dogs. In fact, you know, if you come across a dog you don't know who's loose, don't stare at the dog in the eyes. Keep your eyes low, avert your eyes, because if you look at the dog straight in the eyes, the dog will think you're about to attack. You could attack. That's a sign of, a signal for challenge. Anyway, women, I was saying, for men, they prefer to have someone sitting next to them, not across. For women, they prefer to have someone sitting across from them, not next to them.
This difference between men and women is really fascinating, you know, because it'll make a lot of sense to you, and I'm sure you'll validate it. Roberta, if you sit in a restaurant and you're sitting and having tea, and someone sits next to you, you're not as comfortable as if they're seated opposite you.
No, and that's very true. Yes, it's very true. Because if they're sitting next to me, the corner of my eye kind of gets a picture of them, but I'm not quite sure what they could be up to. They could be up to something that makes me uncomfortable. I can feel myself getting a tension in my body that tells me that I have to watch out. But if they're sitting across from me and I have a visual of them, well, then I can relax because I can easily see what they're doing, and if the need arises, I can leave.
Well, it's interesting because if I have somebody sitting to my right or left, I don't care because they could disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they don't exist for me because I don't feel a threat from right or left. But if I have someone sitting opposite me, I find it far more invasive.
Isn't that interesting? And it's really...
You think it's based on sexual fears?
I do. I do. I think it is based on something sexual because I think that for women, when someone sits next to them, they could be doing something like exposing themselves or like, you know, doing something sexual that the woman does not want to be involved with. And it does happen. You know, what's the name? Flashers and, you know, that kind of exhibitionists. That kind of behavior happens much more likely when that person is side by side, because across from us, an exhibitionist is not going to do that across because that would be too open. There's too much risk. Yeah, there's too much risk. Right, and you would, exactly, you would be much more quicker to react.
So in the personal, we're talking about the four bodily distances. The first one, called intimate, is 0 to 18 inches. If somebody's within 0 to 18 inches of your body, that is considered they're in your personal space, your intimate space.
So unless they are a family relative, you know, like a parent or a child or a sibling or someone you know really well, a spouse, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a really good friend, that proximity feels uncomfortable.
What if they're your dentist? Do you know I went to the dentist? I went to the dentist
the other day. It's uncomfortable. I don't
want
my dentist near me.
I went to the dentist the other day, and he had garlic breath.
Oh, boy.
Heavy garlic breath. And he was 3 inches.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was a dental assistant, actually. It was a man, and he was just heavily garliced.
Mm.
Heavily garliced within 18 inches. Tough
no
stuff.
Good. Yeah, no
Tough
good.
Stuff. I knew a physician who ate a lot of garlic for his health.
Mm-hmm.
Right? 18 mm-hmm. inches, please. 36 would have been easy.
But also, Armand, sometimes when a family member eats garlic, but it's a family member.
That's right.
It doesn't hit you as much as if it's a dentist or, you know, a stranger. Because if it's a family member, there is also their scent combined with the garlic. And because their scent is familiar and it's comfortable, it kind of tones down the discomfort of the garlic smell.
So the space alert, the proximics, get triggered by intimacy, by intimate contact that's not intimate, where a person doesn't have a right to get intimate, and they are within 18 inches of your body, boom, there you have a space threat.
Yeah.
There is something that is in the human body that enables the body to say, wait a minute, what's going on here?
And that's called a personal bubble. And
what is a personal bubble?
Personal bubble is about one arm's length away from your body.
That's
from
about
your
3 feet, right? 1.5 to 4 feet, it says here. Which is the personal, casual.
So if you extend your arms out, and then you spin around, that gives you a kind of a cylinder. That's your personal bubble. Within that bubble, you have extensions of your nervous system, whereby if someone comes into that space, even from behind, and you can't see them, but you feel it. You feel it because there is something in the nervous system of human beings that has developed over the course of millions of years that is very keenly attuned to what happens in that space.
Some people seem to be more attuned than others. Yes. You know, there's the person who, why did you sneak up on me like that?
Right.
When you're just entering a space, because they're not sensitive until you appear.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be different sensitivities. But in the personal bubble, let's talk again about men and women.
Right.
And the difference here.
Right.
If you're standing on a subway.
Right.
And somebody enters your personal bubble, right?
Right.
A woman would rather have the person.
The woman would rather ignore the intrusion and pretend that it didn't happen, because the woman does not want to engage in a possible conflict or, you know, disagreement. You know, the woman has a tendency to ignore the discomfort, whereas most men would challenge the discomfort and kind of maybe give a stern look or even say something.
Make a little grunt or a growl.
Or show a body,
hiss, you know.
a body language that says, hey, you're in my space. What do you want?
What do you want becomes the question,
what do you
know?
You want?
Because
right.
Then there are facial gestures. There's everything that goes along with it.
Right.
That is saying, what are you doing here?
Right.
You know, it's always interesting on a subway. If you're on a subway and then you put down your bags on a subway, how yeah. people defined their territory
mm-hmm.
with bags and jackets. And
yeah.
Or if you go to a movie theater, you know, and people want to sit alone, they put jackets on the chair next to them to say,
right.
stay away from
and
me.
And that's a claiming of territory. And it's also, you know, you have those days where you just don't want anybody near you. And so the way to keep everyone away is to put your things right next to you. Put things down that belong to you right next to you so that no one can sit there.
Yeah, walk around with two porcupines.
Good idea.
One on each side. Put them on the seats.
Good idea, Armand.
You know what the amazing thing is?
What?
When you challenge somebody who's taken more than their space. And if you challenge them about, you know, is that your jacket?
Right.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They become very docile
mm-hmm.
when you take the space.
Yes.
In other words, they don't become grumpy, like, what did you do to my space? But there's a natural tendency when somebody ignores your signal,
mm-hmm.
your extraterrestrial signal, going outside your territory.
Right.
When they ignore it, it kind of makes you docile.
Mm.
It kind of relaxes you.
Well, you know why, Armand? Because that's actually a display of dominance. You know, if you see that someone does not want to share their space, and you impose your presence anyway on that space, what you're doing is you're expressing a dominance behavior over that person. And you're saying, I'm taking your space.
So now the person has only two choices, kill you
right.
or leave you alone.
Exactly.
I see. I see. And most nowadays, thank God.
Right.
They don't. Okay.
You know what's very interesting? Even in primates, like let's say gorillas, you'll see a silverback who is very sensitive about his space. Right. His space is very... You better not mess with the silverback space. And yet, a silverback will be very protective of a baby gorilla space and fears about the space that he's protecting for the little baby gorilla.
Well, what do you mean? How do you protect a space for a baby gorilla?
Yeah, the silverbacks are very protective of the baby gorillas. Silverbacks are extremely tender with the baby gorillas, and they share their space with the baby gorilla, so that the baby gorilla is almost part of that space, of the silverback space. And anybody who comes near the baby gorilla is going to be dealing with the silverback space. It's fascinating to watch.
Sounds like King Kong, you know.
So what you have there is you have a mixture of fierceness. Yes, like King Kong. You have a mixture of fierceness and extreme aggression together with tenderness that is heartbreaking.
This relates to all of you. You know, you may think this. We're talking about the study of proxemics. Roberta Maria Atti and me, Armand DeMille, with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about proxemics, and we're talking about space behaviors. You'll notice your own today. Like, we want to talk about cubicles. In fact, let's shift a little to cubicles,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
A while back, how many, what was the average space that somebody had originally?
Now, like 400 miles in the savannah. Are you talking about the hominids millions of years ago?
Millions of years ago, hominids, they
the
went to work.
Gatherers.
Their day of work was about 400 square miles. No, well, how much space could they carry? Cover?
Well, that means that the 400-mile radius, or no, 400-mile diameter, that was like a circle of space that represented the space onto which the humans would move throughout the year. Not that every day they went back and forth 400 miles, but 400 miles was the personal space in a way of the tribe, of the hunter gatherer. So we used to have a sense of space back then that's very different from what we have now.
It was 440 square miles.
Which
means
huge.
20 miles by 20 miles.
Uh-huh.
You see, so it's 20 miles. But even then,
that's big.
You're living in a 20 mile by 20 mile zone. And now what we've gotten down to is humans who currently work in cubicles, which could be 80 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an 80-square-foot cubicle from down from 20, how did we do it, and what did it do? Office workers spend the day an average of 200. Back in 1986, an average office worker had about 275 square feet
mm-hmm.
as part of his workspace, 275 square feet. Now, they spend their day much further down, and now some stay in their 80-square-foot cubicles. What happened, and what effect does it have on people?
Mm.
Strangely enough, someone predicted, oh, you put people in cubicles, they'll go crazy.
They're very cubicles are very maligned, but actually they're very misunderstood, because a cubicle actually is not a bad solution for a human being, because human beings... Again, let's go back to the toddler's example at the beginning. Human beings don't like to be looked at as they are functioning in their daily routines. They don't like to have a sense that anybody can look at them and spy on them and criticize them. And so actually, in a cubicle, the fact that one is protected from the onlookers gives the person a sense of safety and security. And therefore, it has a calming effect.
So cubicles replaced the more exposed pool desks, where there would be a pool of desks, which used to be these big, big group-occupied workrooms. But now you take a look at how cubicles replaced offices,
mm-hmm.
right, with a closed door. And you say, well, how did that work out so well? Well, my own theory about that is, if you're in a cubicle, you're creative juices and energy are somewhere going up, somewhere beyond that cubicle, and there's a group mind that becomes available, a group work mind. Whereas in private offices with doors closed, you don't have it as much.
Right, you're cut off.
And yes. Being cut off, you know, in Germany,
mm-hmm.
they always close the doors to their offices.
Closed.
In America, you tend to leave them open. The Germans wonder why we're so loose.
Right.
We wonder why they're so isolated.
Right.
The isolated German private office is not in collaboration with all of his associates, because he's very separate.
Mm-hmm, much
that's
more
what
separate.
He does, as opposed to that's what you do. So yeah. Cubicles have turned out to be an okay thing.
Yes, and I'm also thinking in a cubicle, usually an office worker will have a computer that is in a part of a network it's like a nervous system of the company. There's a network of computers all hooked up to one another, so there's a brain that connects all of the workers through the computer. So there's a connection with everyone else through electronic equipment, and it's a fascinating variation on the openness of the savannah, because really you do have a lot of mental space, intellectual space, a lot of nervous system connection through electronics, and the nervous system of human beings has had to adapt to that openness while restricting the physical space more and more. But I think that we're compensating, Armand, and this is my theory, we're compensating for the less and less physical space with the more and more internet space, the more and more...
Oh, very interesting. So we're so opening we need to less and less space because we have...
Because our mind can go anywhere. I mean, if you go on the internet, Armand, you can go anywhere in the world and really be there, in a way. So even though your body is sitting in a cubicle, but your imagination can space in a way that, you know, is unique, I think, in history.
You know about those hotels in Japan where you sleep?
Yes, they're like a coffin.
Yeah, this is a space.
That's too much for me.
This is amazing. It's a hotel where you pay a minimal amount of money, but if you're a businessman in Tokyo and you've traveled from your home, it takes you 4 hours to travel to Tokyo, you spend overnight,
yeah,
and the space is small. I think it's only 4 feet high.
Not even. It's really like a coffin. It's like there's only enough room to lie down.
Crawling into a vault and you lay down.
And you have a TV, you know, as if you were in a coffin, and you have the top of the lid of the coffin over you. There's a TV into the lid so you can watch TV as you lie down, and it's right next to your face. That would be too much for me.
Too much for you.
I don't think I could handle
and
that.
And they seem to be able to do it. They have 300 people in these vaults.
But see,
virtual vaults sleeping there overnight because...
But see, Japan is a good example.
Tokyo is a great example of a small space.
It's a great example of how aggression goes down with the increased population, because Japan, of course, being an island, there's no room. And there's a lot of people. And they are known for their very low level of aggression and violence and crime.
So they easily adapt to smaller spaces,
that's
cooperative
what I meant.
Behaviors, subways.
Right.
You know, talk about an elevator just for a moment. What happens when a man gets into an elevator, and if it's a man by himself, or if a man gets into an elevator, and if you're alone in an elevator, do you tend to want to be nearer or further away from somebody who looks you in the eyes?
Mm. The man would tend to not be comfortable with looking at someone in the eyes. The man would prefer to not have eye to eye and to be further away at the opposite end and to just not have any contact. The women generally prefer to have contact, eye to eye, and to have a chance to look at the person and smile, maybe, to make contact. And I think that again is very revealing of the different ways the nervous systems work. For men, the eye to eye could be challenging and could be a sign of standoff. For a woman, it's a chance to read the other individual's intentions and mood and state of mind. You were saying, Armand, that women being more attuned to the emotional state, when a woman has a chance to make contact eye to eye, I think she has a chance to feel if the other person is aggressive or not.
And I think men are a little less sensitive, so they're just going to go by the cues. And one of the cues when they have eye to eye contact is they say, oop, I'm going to stand off and I'm not going to look at you. So now you get into a subway and the subway gets crowded. The more crowded it gets, do you think you feel more or less threatened? I'm always amazed when I'm on an elevator, and I may be with four or five people on an elevator, and the elevator stops, and the people who are clearly waiting for the elevator say, no, 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 I'll wait for the next one. Even though I say, let's make room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people who won't get in a crowded elevator because of their own fears.
Yeah.
But mostly people do well. Yes. Mostly it's kind of amazing how well people do on elevators. Escalators are a different story. If you're on an escalator and you're a man and there's someone who's close behind you.
Yeah, you tend to react to that. And again, you tend to give signs of discomfort. You know, your body language says you're too close. If you're a woman, you tend to ignore that that person is too close and you just make your way up as fast as you can and leave. So again, you know, these are interesting observations of how we relate to space and how gender relates very differently because of different requirements, different roles and different requirements during evolution.
And your mind, what you think is your own mind and your own comfort, becomes very understandable. Thanks to the positive mind. We're going to take a short break and then want to come back and talk more about living spaces, neighborhoods, and things like that. We'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And this is Reverend Jesse Jackson. Please call and support WBAI, Non-Commercial Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here.
Okay, here we go. Stand by.
From 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here.
Here we go.
WBAI, New York.
Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please, won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor?
Neighbor.
Television neighbor, I'm glad we're together again.
Hey there, Mr. Rogers.
Oh, that was so nice to hear.
You like Mr. Rogers?
I like his theme song.
You soften every time you hear it.
Yeah, it reminds me of those years when I used to watch every day with my kids. And, you know, I got to know Mr. Rogers rather well, and he had a way with space and neighbors. yes, it's a tender feeling.
Hey, you know, there's a thing about neighborhood that's kind of important. What defines a neighborhood? You know, Roberta, didn't we have that somewhere? What is the definition of a neighborhood? It's a certain square footage that you have. And in the square footage of your house.
Yeah, it's where you have your nest, and then you have things that are familiar, like a juvenile, teaching facility that we call a school. You have a couple of foraging spots, like a supermarket and the mall, where you go and forage. You have maybe a couple of places where you gather with your friends, like a coffee shop or, you know, a public space, a library or maybe a park. And then you have a couple of night spots where you go at night to socialize and have a drink or something.
Yeah, there usually be one or two bars in your neighborhood,
right. So
whether you go or not, but that's part of the neighborhood.
A neighborhood is where you have this kind of landmark spots that you get to be familiar with, the spot itself and the people that are there with you, and this becomes your neighborhood that you relate to as your extended space. But then your home space, now it's different, because if someone were to visit your home, and you being the host and they being the guest, then you have a very strict set of rules as to what the host and guest are or are not supposed to do.
What's that about?
Well, for instance, a guest has to ask for permission to use the bathroom, right? If you're the host and they're the guest, they don't just go to the bathroom and say, may I use your bathroom?
Really?
Sure. You don't do that, Armand? You go to people's homes
I
and
just
take over?
No, I don't take over, but I figured... Of course, you ask permission.
Well, and also, usually, for instance, the host's bedroom, even if they're a relative, you don't go into the bedroom.
I don't know it, but I could see it. You know, the bedroom, you don't go into their bedroom.
Bedroom is the personal space where you just don't go, unless it's your bedroom, you don't go into someone's bedroom.
I remember going to someone's house who had a big terrace around their house, and when you would pass the terraces, you would look inside. Part of the inside was the bedroom, and people would always be uncomfortable looking at that part.
Sure.
It's like, I shouldn't be peeking in your bedroom.
Right. No, we know it's an unspoken rule that you don't look into a person's bedroom.
So if a person's showing you around their home and they show you to their bedroom,
no.
It's a place you kind of go in and out of real quickly.
No, yes, no, you don't
show
the bedroom.
You don't jump
bedroom.
On the bed to see how nice the springs are, you know?
You don't look at the color of the sheets, no. Actually, no, if someone shows their home, they rarely will show you the bedroom. Because, also, think about it, if someone shows you their bedroom, they could be implying that, you know, a sexual invitation of some sort. So generally the bedroom is left out.
Hmm.
So the host has body language and facial messaging that signifies, I'm the boss here, and you are here under my control, and you're only going to do what I allow you to do. It's not spoken that way, but it's agreed by the host and guest.
So the host is the owner of the space, or the one who has a space in their name,
and
the visitor comes to the host. What if the visitor is a four-year-old
kid? Well, and the host
it's a four-year-old child, the rules are all off.
Very different, yes. The host always is the dominant in that relationship, even if normally on the outside it wouldn't be that way, but the host is the dominant person because they're in their territory in that relationship. The guest is always the obedient, because the guest has to abide by the host's rules. And the guest really needs to spend some time figuring out what is and is not acceptable by the host. So if you go into someone's home, for instance, based on their ethnic background, you're going to watch for certain things, not to offend them. You know, like I know that if you use your silverware in a certain way, for some people, it can be a threat, or it's considered, you know, offensive. And, you know, you just watch what you do, much more so than if you're in a public place.
You know, I've always found one of the great things when I've had guests is when the guest cleans. There is something about a guest trying to straighten things up, or trying to clean, or trying to be part of making your place pretty, that touches me deeply. And I think it's a way that you welcome yourself into a home more.
It's
you welcome by at least offering to help.
It's also a way to express, you know, to tell the host that you're safe, that you're not going to do damage to their things.
Right. I want to take care of your place. I don't want to do damage to your place. But when a guest walks in with a four-year-old child.
Yeah, well, good luck.
Good. Well, you've dealt with a lot of four-year-old kids.
I did. You know what I did once, Armand? I had a party, and my daughter must have been six, and so I had a bunch of six-year-olds running around. And this party, you know, I realized that there was no point in trying to control the situation. So what I did was I started a food fight myself.
Uh-huh.
Rather than to leave it up to the kids to, you know, make a mess, I started to make the mess myself, and I started to throw food around, and so they joined me, and we threw food around for a couple of hours, and I sent the kids home. I think the parents of those children still hate me to this day, because I sent the kids home covered with food. But, yeah, it's like that with four-year-olds.
Americans spend an estimated 70 years indoors.
Hmm.
You know, if an American lives 75 years, 80 years, 70 of them are spent indoors.
Yeah.
70 indoors, mostly in the secure habitat of an average-sized 2,000-square-foot residence called a home, or... And what they do, how do they do, how do you live inside for so long? Well, you bring the outside inside, so you have replicas of plants, you have warm lighting, you have colors, vistas,
pictures
of sunset. Mm-hmm. You bring the outside in.
Right.
Right? Your windows are there to keep you connected to the outside.
Well, in a way,
95% of your life is being spent indoors.
Having a pet also is a way...
Keeps you indoors.
But is also a way to bring the outdoors inside. Because if you have a pet, you have a living thing there. You know, it's reminding you that, yeah, you're in a closed space, but there is life... right outside the door. I mean, I think it's a way to keep yourself surrounded with the living things that you would have around you if you lived outside.
I was going to get a pet rhinoceros for my bathroom. I thought it was a good idea. Somebody showed me a baby rhinoceros. It was like the size of a dog. I figured it might not be a bad idea.
I wonder if you can do the same thing like what you do with the bonsai, with the rhinoceros.
Oh, I wouldn't want to do it. You mean clip their toenails?
Something like that.
Something like that to keep them small. They have little rhinos.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That'd be cute.
No. Okay, upon reentering a home after you've been away for a long space, here's another space psychology thing. Another thing about the psychology of space. You come into your own home. What happens every time you walk in your home? Are you looking around? Are you glancing? Now, it's different among different people.
But it seems that most people, when they return home, the longer they've been away, the more time they spend just walking around, smelling, checking things, looking at things, looking to see if everything is still the way they left it, looking basically for signs of intrusion. So that's actually normal behavior. The longer you stay away, say if you stay away 2 hours, you're not going to do that a whole lot. If you stay away 2 weeks, when you come back, you're probably going to spend 5 minutes at least walking around and looking at everything.
You know, I live in an apartment building. When I am away for a week or 2 weeks, as I'm approaching it with a taxi cab from the airport or something, I'm looking to see if it's burned down.
Yeah.
I'm looking to see the window. Okay, is the window still there? That's the beginning.
That's interesting.
That's the beginning. Is the window there? Okay, and then you walk in and you start correcting. But what happens if you have a plumber come into your space when you're not there?
Yeah, most people are not comfortable with someone being in their space while they're not there. And this is true, I think, especially for women. There is a sense of maybe having been invaded, intruded upon, even violated. Because, well, you don't know what this person did. You don't know what they saw. You don't know. There's a sense that your personal bubble, the bubble that we defined before, has not been safe, even though you weren't there. But your space was there. And because your space is perceived in your nervous system as an extension of you, if someone is in your space while you're not there, you feel the discomfort of that invasion, that intrusion.
You know, there's been some interesting research about people who have people who clean. Now, if you're a working mother and you've got a couple of kids, don't you think, Roberta, it would be wonderful to have somebody come in and clean your house every day?
No.
Well, you see, but you're a working, you're out every day, you've got kids
and
at home.
And people always say, why don't you get someone to help you? But no, it would feel like an intrusion.
You won't allow it?
No. No.
Well, you know men do.
In fact, when I did have someone who used to help me clean, she would come when I was there, and I would work with her. Not because I wanted to save money, but because I wanted to be with her while she was doing the work. It makes me uncomfortable if someone is there when I'm not.
Well, they found that men are not as uncomfortable with that.
I wonder.
You know what I think it's about?
Why?
I think it's about men have mommies, want their mommies to take care of them.
Mm.
You know, it doesn't matter so much because I don't think the men feel judged by the people who clean their spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But I think women do.
I do.
You know, like they're going to go through your personal drawer and...
Yes, and then she's going to see that, you know, I don't keep my shoes lined up or something or things like that. And that's going to be embarrassing.
You don't keep your shoes
lined up?
I don't.
They're all thrown in a bunch.
Uh-oh. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Stay in your own backyard. That's an expression we say to people. You know, what does a fence do? You think a fence keeps people out?
It keeps people in.
it really defines your space, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And in the U.S., people are obsessed with fence, it seems.
How much square fence do we have? Enough fence. Oh, I know. You could ask me. Ask me. How much square...
Armand, how many square feet of fencing do Americans use?
Americans use 38,880 miles of chain link. They use 31,680 miles of wooden link. And 1,440 miles of ornamental fencing. They use all of these things, and that if you were to put them all together, you could go to the moon and back twice.
Amazing.
That's how much fence we have.
It reminds me of what's the Chinese wall? Remember that wall?
They still have the wall.
The huge wall? Yeah, the Great Wall, it's called. Armand, you know, if you think about squabbles that happen between neighbors, they always seem to happen on both sides of the fence. One neighbor on this side and the other neighbor on that side, and the squabble is right there at the boundary.
At the boundary of the fence, with nobody climbing over to go get the other person. It's like, this is as far as you can go and as far as I could go.
Yeah.
Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind with Roberta Maria Atti. There's a certain thing called, there's a book called Fixing Broken Windows, which was by a Rutgers criminologist, George Kelling. It became a Bible in the zero tolerance policy towards abandoned cars, abandoned building, and now graffiti. What happens, Roberta, the minute the graffiti goes up on a wall?
What happens is it gives a signal to the neighbor in that neighborhood. It gives a signal to people that it's okay to vandalize things, that things are tolerated, that the destructive behavior, the anger expression in that behavior is tolerated, and so it encourages more of it and more destructive versions of it. So it seems that if you wake up one day and you find there's a graffiti on some wall near your home, your immediate reaction to that is one of becoming defensive because
you feel violated.
It feels like an invasion, yeah.
And it is an invasion. That's the idea of it. The idea
is
I want you, I'm going to claim this territory.
Yes, that's what that is. Yes, it's a way to...
And the higher up the wall, the better it is. What about the neurological stuff related to this, Roberta?
Well, the neurological stuff related to this is fascinating, but, I mean, there's so much to say that we could perhaps do a whole show about that. But the neurological thing is that the brains of people develop... A whole area of the brain develops according to the territory we live in. So let's say that someone chooses to be a cab driver for a living. That part of their brain and nervous system is going to be very well developed and very highly sophisticated because they have to have a current ongoing map of the city that they have to know very well. And they have to memorize it, and they have to keep it running all the time. So they have to, you know, this gives them an extra couple of pounds of brains in that part of the brain. And the bigger the territory is that you inhabit, the more complex this map, of course, has to become. Also, what was found was that people who travel a lot, because they have to, in a way, they have to do something that is not natural, because naturally we live within our territory and we don't really go out that much. We don't, you know, the hunter-gatherers had their territory, and if they went, if they strayed outside of that, they could get into serious danger. So when people travel a lot, they have to develop a whole new set of neurons that are normally not there, but that in the long run gives them an advantage. It gives them almost an extra capacity for learning spatial skills and for relating to space with flexibility and, you know, with ease.
Aren't there certain damages that to the brain, like the parietal lobes, that will stop you in your ability to have a decent spatial concept?
Yeah, if there's a damage that is done to the right hemisphere, to the place that is in charge of learning about space, then you can no longer figure your way out. You can no longer memorize maps in your brain of, you know, even of your neighborhood where you live.
And we think sometimes that there's something wrong with people who have bad spatial concepts. You know, and there is. I mean,
yeah.
a spatial concept is important. When a person cannot judge spaces, you know, there may be damage.
Well, and it also might have something to do with the eye-to-brain coordination. Like in driving, Armand, it's extremely important to have a good relationship with space. If you are afraid, in some way you're afraid of, there's something in your relationship with space that brings up fear for whatever reason, driving doesn't come easy, because you have to, when you're at the wheel of a car that goes that fast, you have to be comfortable in your space that moves that fast. And so, you know, so if you're not, then you're afraid to drive, and then that can be a problem, of course. Armand, remember that guy that was in love with the Queen of England?
Michael Fagan.
And bypassed...
That's right, Fagan.
Bypassed all of the security and
found... But he was crazy, wasn't he?
...her bedroom. Yeah, but he was harmless. He didn't mean to hurt her. He just wanted to have a glass of wine with her. And he found his way through all the protection, and she went to her bedroom one night and found him there with a glass of wine in his hand. He wanted to have a glass of wine with her in her bed. He was romantically in love with her. Now, that is a typical example of someone who has broken all of the rules of space.
And he did it instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't that he was just, you know, if 100 people tried, he somehow knew how to break the rules.
Well,
and to get to her bedroom, which is he had to get past, you know, flags and coats of arms and sentries.
And that makes you wonder, I mean, how did he do it? How did he get there?
Reminds me of the guy who flew his airplane on the lawn of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how is that possible with all the space and all the regulations? You know, it always kind of amazes me when people talk about the property they own. Like, I own my home.
Mm-hmm.
And you can own your home today, and a wave could come tomorrow, and your home could be part of nature again.
Right.
You don't own anything, and the spaces are not defined, and they're not definite. And your personal space doesn't really exist because you're connected to every other human.
Right.
It's all an illusion.
We're all in the soup.
We're all in the soup. With a little garlic.
With a lot of garlic.
Hey, this is Armand Amour with Roberta Maria Atti. Wish we had more time. It's such a fascinating subject. But, you know,
maybe
do some work on
it.
And, well, I think they could do a little research and look up, what's the word?
Agoraphobia?
No.
Oh, proxemics.
Proxemics. PROXIMICS. My friend, take a look at proxemics. Study a little more. You'll find yourself fascinated. We will be back with you soon. I'll be back tomorrow at 1 p.m. If you wanted to go to the websites, it's thepositivemind.com. And Roberta, how do they get to yours?
It's creativehealthsolutions.org.
Be back with you tomorrow, my friends.
This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Apti. Food fights and wine with the Queen. That could have been King Henry. Had him burned at the stake, would he not? Armand?
Yeah, I'm here. No,
did you hear what I said?
Was it King Henry?
Well, it wasn't King Henry.
Would not. He was absolutely...
King Henry would have burned him. Burned him right at the stake. All right. The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Apti. Thank you so much for joining us. It is 1:55. What is this? Oh, I guess this wasn't supposed to go. Well, let it play. Let it roll. Coming up at 2 p.m. will be Light Show with Vic the Bruiser. Vic the Bruiser is in the house and with her waterproof shoes on because it is raining heavily in New York City right now. It is 44 degrees and raining in New York at 99.5 FM. That is the radio frequency you're listening to. And as I said, Vic the Bruiser will be on with Light Show. Vicki Hipple bringing you the Light Show here at 2 o'clock. Talk back with Hugh Hamilton at 3 p.m. And please, once again, visit our website at WBAI.org. My name is Michael G. Haskins, the radio host, and I thank you so much for tuning in.
Higher, let 'em drop forward.